third case this morning, Wells v. Bissard. Oh, I'm sorry, that's been vacated. U.S. v. Garvey. Mr. Ward?
May it please the Court, my name is Frank Ward and I represent the appellant, Eric Garvey. Since March 2004, there have been three Supreme Court decisions, all establishing that the out-of-court statements of a non-testifying witness, which are testimonial, are barred by the Confrontation Clause. However, the government tried this case as if those three decisions did not exist by putting an analyst on the stand who appeared to basically read the notes and report of another analyst into evidence. If John Nee was not going to testify to his own expert opinion, the government could have simply had John Nee perform the tests on the substances again, especially since the substances were still available. In the response brief, the government relies on United States v. Turner to support their contention that the Confrontation Clause was not violated. However, unlike in Turner, nowhere in his testimony did John Nee testify to his own expert opinion. Unlike the expert in Turner, nowhere in his testimony did John Nee explain any of the procedures for testing and processing evidence at the Wisconsin State Crime Lab or any of the safeguards put in place to prevent the tampering with of evidence. When shown the substances at issue, John Nee even admitted that he had never seen the substances before. When John Nee was asked what his opinion was as to what the substances contained, he simply stated that after reviewing Andrew Slice's data, he believed that the substances contained methamphetamine. However, that was not John Nee's conclusion. That was a conclusion of Andrew Slice. Because of this, the defense had no opportunity to examine what that actual data was that Mr. Slice put together or examine any of the opinions or conclusions that Andrew Slice came to. The defense was not able to examine the testing procedures that were used in order to test these substances, whether the machines were properly maintained, whether there was any complications in the testing procedures which could have jeopardized the substances at issue. Additionally,
let me ask you this. Nee had concluded himself that the substance was meth, and the original analyst left to take a new job. It's a little different from this Bull Cumming case where he hadn't been placed on unpaid leave for unknown reasons, which, of course, that would have been great cross-examination material in that case. Isn't that an important difference from the Supreme Court case? What's the situation in our case or your case?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, while it was stated that Andrew Slice resigned from the Wisconsin State Crime Lab, there was no further evidence provided why the government could not have brought Andrew Slice still in to testify. All that was simply stated was that he now resigned. Further discussing the testimony of John Nee, when he was asked what the quantities of the substances at issue contained, all he simply stated was Andrew Slice reported that the quantities were, and he would state Andrew Slice's report. It almost appeared as if he was reading the notes and report of Andrew Slice into evidence.
Now, even if Nee's testimony should not have been admitted, does it rise to the level of plain error? Because I think that's really a huge issue here. Here we have four recorded buys. We have testimony, for example, that it makes you run fast, which was referring, at least according to the government, to high-quality meth. So if we allow that to stand, that testimony, or acknowledge that it was admitted incorrectly, why is there plain error?
Yes, Your Honor, there is plain error here because the testimony, without this testimony, there would be no other direct evidence as to what these substances contained. While we acknowledge that there was other circumstantial evidence, including the mention of code words in some of these recordings, there was never a mention of the word drugs or methamphetamine. And in addition, the special agent, Daniel Bethards, testified that that these code words can mean different things depending on different regions.
Final question from me is, you know, the Williams v. Taylor case is pending before the Supreme Court. Do you think we should hold off on ruling in our case until that case is decided? I would expect it would come out in June, but, I mean, what's your sense on that?
People v. Williams is pending, and while we recognize the holding that was in that case and while it's under review, that case was different from ours in that the expert in that case did testify to her own expert opinion. While she did look to, in that case, she looked to a DNA report and also a blood sample and conducted, you know, while she reviewed those reports and testified to that, she did not base her opinion on that. She reviewed them, compared them, ran her own statistical data in that case, comparing how likely it would be to have an error as to that it was a match between the DNA test and the blood test. So she did conduct her own independent review there, and she testified to that.
So you don't think we would need any additional briefing once that case came down?
I do not believe so, Your Honor, but if that decision came down and did affect this one, then I could see a need for additional briefing, but we don't believe that it will have a substantial effect on this case.
All right. Thank you.
John Need never testified to any of his own independent review or independent testing he did anywhere in the on the substances. In addition, he never explained any peer review that he did on the substances tested. The government's only support for the fact that there was any peer review done here is a letter they have attached to their brief. However, other than that, John Need never testified to any peer review that he did on the substances or any signing off on any of Andrew Slice's work or reports. As in Melendez-Diaz, the lab results in Schleiss's report were testimonial statements, as they were proof of not only the contents but the weight of the substances tested. By allowing John Need to simply reiterate the testing conclusions of Mr. Slice, the government basically was allowed to admit Mr. Slice's report without providing the defense an opportunity to examine the credentials, testing procedures, and opinions of Mr. Slice. As established in Bullcoming v. New Mexico, the testimonial statements in Andrew Slice's report convey more than a machine-generated number. Mr. Slice's representations in that report were meant for cross-examination, especially when the testifying expert provided no evidence of any peer review whatsoever. Mr. Garvey's Sixth Amendment right to confrontation was violated when John Eade was allowed to testify. If there are no further questions from the court, we request that Eric Garvey's conviction be vacated and this case be remanded for a new trial.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Peter Jarrell for the United States. Your Honor, in this particular case, despite what the defense is saying, what they're saying here is that Mr. Need did not offer an independent opinion. That's just contrary to the facts. It may have not been presented the way the defendant wants, but in each individual case, when Mr. Need was asked his opinion about what the substance was, he rendered an independent opinion. He says, I reviewed the data, and in my opinion, it was methamphetamine. The problem here, if there is a problem, because they're taking too wide of a net, I would only suggest, is that when we get to the amount of the drug, and in that particular situation, as I pointed out in my brief, if Mr. Need's testimony went too far, it may have gone too far in that regard. But that drug amount was simply not essential to the case in any form.
Well, the testimony physically describe how this testimony went down. He carried the report with him and then referred to it as he testified?
Well, Your Honor, he actually had the reports with him, true, but he, not the reports, but he had the entire file, as the record demonstrates. And as the defendant started to cross-examine him on these things, but as in all these situations, not all of them, but in I think anecdotally you can say in your experience, they don't find that a fruitful avenue to pursue, because you start talking about all the testing and the procedures and the jury's falling asleep and it's 5:30 in the afternoon and everybody's done hearing about that kind of stuff. And so he doesn't really pursue it. But he had the information. He can cross-examine him on the data. And in fact, during the cross-examination, he starts asking him, what does this test mean? And he brought up onto the form one of the graphs, the mass spectrometer or something, one of the graphs, and he started asking about it. What does this peak mean? What do these things mean? And Mr. Need, of course, is testifying and explaining with 30-plus years' experience exactly what's going on and how it works. So it's not simply he's reciting his what Mr. Schleiss ended up reporting in his opinion. The dilemma and the odd dilemma is this. In all due respect, of course the opinions are going to be the same. It would be kind of funny if they weren't. One chemist came up here that the government's going to present that says it's methamphetamine. Oh, and we're going to present another one at trial that's going to say it's not methamphetamine. Of course they're going to be the same. So ostensibly, it looks as though, oh gosh, all you've done is read in Mr. Schleiss's report and his conclusions, because lo and behold, you came up with the same conclusions. But that's not what occurred here. Mr. Need examined the data, examined the analysis, and that's what happened. None of the decisions that have been rendered so far talk about the idea of an independent conclusion based upon the testing done by another person, except for the Williams versus Illinois case that is currently on cert. But in that case, as I pointed out a distinction in the footnote 4 in my brief, in that particular case, there is a somewhat of a difference. It's not totally analogous, because what you have is a situation where the Clearmark report is actually being entered into evidence. The Clearmark report, which is a separate test done by a separate lab, unlike here where it was the same lab and it was a colleague and there was peer review. What you have in the Williams case is the Clearmark report is basically being introduced plainly into evidence, and then they're talking about it.
So in terms of this peer review process, do you have any cases that support this as being a sufficient basis for an expert to testify? Because as I understand it, Nia didn't observe the test. He didn't, you know, he didn't do anything personally. He didn't sign off on it. It wasn't like he was a supervisor whose job was to review all the testing and then sign off as a final check to make sure the actual analyst went through everything.
Well, Your Honor, no, I would disagree respectfully. He did do the peer review. He was the peer review. He was also the unit supervisor in that.
Now, okay, so I misunderstood that.
But let me go back. In terms of putting that into the testimony, in terms of the explicitly, hey, what exactly does the peer review involve? What sort of things did you do? No, that wasn't in part of the testimony.
Yeah, I didn't see. I didn't see. That's what prompted this question as to what it. He made reference to it, but there was no spelling out as to what it was, and so that's why I was questioning what his real role was in this space, because I didn't understand what peer review was. That testimony was not in the record then.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I guess what I'm relying upon and the government's relying upon in this case is the general notion under 703 and 702 that an expert can reasonably rely upon the data and analysis created by others if it's reasonably relied upon by them in rendering their opinions, and that's what they did here.
Were the crime lab reports in the record at all?
No.
I mean, that is the results of the testing?
Absolutely not. No, nothing was put in except for Mr. Need's opinion. And I just want to simply point out, because it was brought up before and I think it needs to be emphasized, this is plain error review. If this was a non-issue at trial, as you can tell by the brevity and the testimony of this whole matter, the defense had complete rein to cross-examine Mr. Need as much as he wanted to. But yet there was absolutely no objection made. If there would have been an objection, then virtually every one of these issues would have been resolved. This just is not plain error. In the cases that have been cited, none of those cases are plain error cases. Turner, Bullcoming, Melendez-Diaz, none of those are plain error review cases. This is a plain error review. I could stand corrected on this, but I don't think even Williams is a plain error review. So what we have is a significantly different situation than those cases. We have just a classic case of the defendant, or rather the Mr. Need, offering an independent opinion.
And I guess it's not appropriate for us to speculate as to why the original examiner analyst was not there, because there was no showing here that he was unavailable or unwilling or anything to testify.
Right, Your Honor, all I indicated that he had left. I'd written a letter to the defendant, as I indicated in the brief and attached it, was part of the record on the court below. Mr. Schleiss had left. It was easier to call Mr. Need. I don't want to minimize this at all. It's a four hand-to-hand sales by controlled surveillance with code words being used consistent with methamphetamine distribution. Wording on the amounts being sold, money that you can derive, how much it is, and what's being done. There is a ton of evidence against Mr. Garvey to show it was methamphetamine, to show the amounts that was that were delivered. And most important, the amounts were simply not essential to this case. And as a result, there really was no error. And if there was error at all, it certainly wasn't plain error. According to the four standards in Alano.
Yeah, and of course I understand your position, but if the original analyst had been called, we wouldn't even be here today.
That's absolutely right. Correct, Your Honor. But I'm not sure that the failure to call him would necessarily mean that in all cases that would be error, because an expert has the right to rely on testing done by other people. And that is, in a way, what the Williams case, although we're not addressing it here and it's not before us, that is what the Williams case is sort of talking about.
So then what would your view be on Williams? Should we wait on that decision? I mean, I know you make some reference to it in a footnote.
Well, Your Honor, if the court wishes to wait, then that's fine. I think that there's ways to distinguish this. I think that Turner, as this case, it controls in this situation. Turner, cert has been granted in Turner, I think, because of the Williams decision. I can't say that for certain. But Turner, which we are relying upon, cert has been granted in that particular situation, too. If the court wishes to wait to see what happens, there's that would obviously be within the court's discretion.
And the problem is, though, that the facts that are revealed in Turner were not actually put in the record in this case. That is, as to the role of that supervisor.
Right, because there were objections made beforehand. There was motions in limine. The whole thing was ferreted out. It was an issue in Turner. And here, it never was an issue. And it only became an issue on appeal when it was thought of as an issue to talk about. If there are no other questions, then the government requests that the judgment and order of conviction be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. How much?
While the government referenced the amount of drugs not being essential to the case, it was never our position that the amount of drugs were essential to the case. That his testimony regarding the amount of drugs and him, you know, it basically reading Andrew Schleiss's conclusions that this is what the amount of drugs were was just further proof that Johnny did not testify to his own expert opinion. There was also testimony where he was questioned about the containers that the substance was placed in, the baggies, asking, you know, were they full bags, were they partial bags? He attempted to explain it, but then became confused, and in his testimony he stated, I think we better just refer to Mr. Schleiss's report, and then read from the report as to what types of containers these substances were contained in. Also, the government raised the issue of, in his testimony, there was some discussion of some spectrometry graphs. However, those were not addressed until cross-examination, when counsel brought them for John Need to ask him what these meant. He never brought, you know, in his when he was explaining his opinion as to what these substances contained, he never stated, you know, in looking to his data and looking to the spectrometry charts and looking to this, after that review, I was able to conclude that this was methamphetamine. The defense counsel simply put those in front of him, and he explained, well, a chart like this, a peak on the graph would mean that it contained this. In addition, the counsel pointed out that it's unlikely that their opinions would be different. However, the cross-examination of Schleiss would have given us the opportunity to explore the possibility that it wasn't methamphetamine. And finally, he points out Rule 703. While 703 does entitle an expert to rely on the report of another analyst, that was meant for Andrew Schleiss. He could testify to, I relied on this report, this data, and then in conducting my own review, my own analysis, I came to this conclusion, whereas John Eade was simply reiterating the reports and conclusions of Andrew Schleiss. If there are no further questions from the court, we request that Eric Garvey's conviction be vacated and this case be remanded for a new trial.
Thank you, counsel.